Thank you very much for your speech this evening. I definitely recommend everyone to stay. We'll have a short reception afterwards and some light refreshments in the back. But right now, please come up to the mic and pose any questions that you'd like.
Yes, sir.
Hi. Thanks for coming. I have so many questions for you, but I'm just going to ask one because I know they usually limit us to one here. So I've been curious with the Republican mantra, conservative mantra of broaden the base and lower the rate and the fair taxes and things like that. It's always perceived, people think that like 46, 47% of Americans don't pay taxes because they're too poor to. And then also at the top, you end up, so basically it looks like you're screwing the poor people and giving a break to the rich people. That's what it looks like every time they talk about lower the rate and broaden the base. So I'm just wondering why, and actually it has the additional side effect of looking like they're giving away gifts to the people that bankroll their campaigns. So I'm wondering why hasn't anyone ever proposed the conservatives a budget that cuts spending, since spending is apparently the problem, and just leaves the taxes alone, just doesn't touch it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, first of all, let me say this. I believe, and you can stay up there because we can go back and forth on this. Like, I think two things need to be done if we're going to get the deficit under control. I don't think there's any argument about this. I mean, even Barack Obama and I agree on this. You got to get the economy growing again. You know, if you we're not going to balance the budget ever if we continue to have negative real income growth, which we've had for the last 4 years, and if we continue to have 15 million people out of a job. I mean, you're never going to balance the budget. You need every American working. You need incomes to rise. You're going to see a flood of revenues into the government once that happens. I mean, in the 80s, when Reagan, you know, when I showed you the tax rate went from 70 to 28%, guess what? The tax revenues doubled. We had a flood of revenues because the economy improved and we put 18 million people back to work. That's what we have to do on the tax side, and that's why tax policy is so important. We have the start of this month, the United States become the highest corporate tax rate country in the world. Gets back to what I was talking about, competitiveness. That doesn't work anymore, right? That doesn't work. We can't compete on a global scale if we put our corporations at a 10 or 15 percentage point disadvantage over other countries. So I do think tax policy matters a lot, and I think we can do much better than we got right now. I'm very much in favor of getting rid of loopholes. That's what the president talked about this week. Yes, by all means, let's get rid of the mortgage deduction, charitable deduction, you know, the deductions for windmills and bull sperm and all this stuff. Get rid of all that, and then use the money that you save to lower the rates. That was what we did in 86, and it worked very well. I don't see any reason we can't get the highest tax rate in the United States down to 20-25%. And by the way, I honestly believe also if you make it a consumption-based tax, so you don't double tax capital gains and dividends and risk-taking, you're just going to see a boom in this economy. But you're also right. We need to do something about the entitlement side and the spending side, and I think that means everything. I mean, the first thing I would do is that if I were president, I'd cut every agency by 15 or 20%. I mean, we just got to do it. We can't afford the spending that we have right now. And then I would do something about these big boulders of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. I mean, what Paul Ryan's budget, which is so controversial, is saying is it's telling every young person in this room, guess what? If you think you're going to get Social Security and Medicare at 64 or 65, you got another thing coming, because you're not. You're not. And all the Republicans are doing is being honest with you and telling you you're going to probably not get that till you're 68 or 69 or 70. And by the way, you know, by the time you guys are 70 years old, the life expectancy will probably be well over 100. So, you know, we can't keep paying people to be on the dole for 30 or 40 years. I think you got to do both of those things. And I don't, maybe that message isn't getting across, but I think we got to really get people back to work. Is that?
Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned the revenue and kind of the Laffer curve issue, because that was another question I had.
Yeah.
You showed the one graph and it showed the share that the top 1% were paying. And I think 99% of people don't care what the top 1% are paying. I think I would have liked to see a revenue or a GDP or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of curious also, which obviously you and I think that we're on different sides of the Laffer curve. And I'm curious why you
By the way, I'm not, let me be clear on this. I don't think that if you cut tax rates, you're going to get more revenues. I don't buy that. But I do think you're going to get more growth. And what we ought to do is be at the tax rate that doesn't Some people think that the point of the Laffer curve is to be at the point where you raise the most revenue. No. I think you should be at the point where you fund the things you have to in government, but you're maximizing growth. And I'll tell you this, that for the personal income tax rate, it's a whole hell of a lot less than 43%, 44%. I think the maximizing rate on income tax is probably, closer to 18, 19, 20 to 25%. And by the way, same thing on capital gains. I mean, there's no question, by the way, if we raise our capital gains right to 30%, we'll actually be on the wrong side of the Laffer curve. And the history just proves it. And the reason, by the way, that that's, I don't want to get in the weeds on this, but the capital gains tax is a voluntary tax. So if you raise the tax rate to 30%, people just won't sell they'll lock in, they won't sell their stocks. Is that it?
Okay. Yeah, I have so much more. I'll let someone else
ask. If you want to ask me some other stuff later, happy to do it. Thank you, sir. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate your perspective. One thing I want to just point out, I am more on the liberal side, but I believe in individual responsibility.
Sure.
So I want to talk to you about your position a little bit on healthcare.
Yeah.
I'm a master's in health administration student, so one of the things that we're looking to do is understand how do you get patients to be more responsible for their care, and how do you encourage individual responsibility in that light.
Right.
Obviously, doing price shopping for healthcare providers is important.
Sure.
But if you look at the outcomes that we've had thus far, compare that to other countries such as Germany or Japan, where they have regulated prices for their markets, for their healthcare markets, you see that they have much better outcomes in Japan and Germany, and they have much lower percentage of GDP as spent on healthcare. So my question to you would be, at what point, or one of the correlators to that is we had Jerry Anderson, I'm not sure if you know the name, but he speaks down, he teaches at Bloomberg at the School of Public Health, and he talks about how it's the prices. It's just the prices that healthcare providers have to charge to the insurance companies or to the patients.
Right.
They make their own prices. It's market-driven right now.
Yeah.
So my question to you is, at what point, it's a two-part question, at what point does the government kind of step in and say, okay, these are what the regulated prices should be, and is there a point for any industry where the government should be involved at that level, or do you believe in completely opposite spectrum where the market should just drive the complete costs?
All right, it's a great question. Thank you for asking it. So, and we could talk literally for an hour about it because there's so many nuances of this, but let me just give you some thoughts. I mean, one thing to think about, this is going to seem an odd thing to say because it almost contradicts what I said before, but one reason that healthcare is so expensive in America today is it's worth it. That is to say, the quality of healthcare that we get in the United States is unquestionably, in my opinion, superior to virtually anywhere else in the world. I mean, if you really get cancer, if you really get heart disease, if you really get some serious chronic disease, I guarantee you don't want to go to a hospital in Canada. You don't want to go to a hospital in Britain. You don't want to go to a hospital in Germany. You want to go to the place in the world that has the highest quality care, all of the new medications, all of the new therapies and treatments, and that's in the United States. I mean, I was just I spent 2 days at the Cancer Center Treatment of America. It's amazing what is going on there. And by the way, that's a very patient-driven system, and it's just revolutionizing the way that we treat people with cancer, and they're doing it in a very affordable way. So please, please, please don't believe this nonsense that, they have better health care in Canada than we have in the United States. It just isn't true. Now, it is true that we do have a big segment of the population that doesn't have access to that system. And I think the way I would change it is, and by the way, my LASIK surgery, I wish that professor were here because I would ask him, if you don't think a market system can work in healthcare to drive down costs, then explain to me why we've seen a two-thirds reduction in LASIK surgery in all of these other types. I mean, another good example is, if you look at, this may not be such a good example, but the cost of veterinarians. I mean, veterinarians provide health care, right? But they provide it for animals, not people. The cost of veterinary care has not gone up nearly as much as it has for people. Why? Because people don't have insurance, although that's actually changing now, too. People are now getting health insurance for their dogs and cats. But here's how I would change the system. First of all, if you look across states, you do see a very big divergence of the cost of health insurance. So Arizona has, health insurance premiums that might be, $4,000 a year, where New Jersey and New York may be as high as $10,000 or $12,000 a year. So it's not surprising that New York and New Jersey, more people don't have health insurance. Why? Because in Arizona, they don't require everything to be covered by health insurance. And so what I would do is I would basically provide people with a very large deductible, like maybe $5,000, or even you can make it a percentage of people's income. But for an average family, let's say with an income of $50,000, they have a $5,000 deductible. What does that mean? You're going to pay out of pocket for your first $5,000 expenditure. If you go to the doctor for, you know, for basic care or something like that, you're going to pay that out of pocket. And by the way, there's something called medical savings account. I don't want to get too much into this, where you basically have people paying out of their medical saving account. It's like an IRA, and what they don't use, they get to save. That changes the incentive structure. People do shop around. And one of the interesting things is, by the way, because we, one of the things that's changed so much in just the last 4 or 5 years, I mean, anybody in this room who knows, you know, I'm sure everybody in this room has either a close friend or a family member that's had cancer. Everyone I know, a lot of friends, and I have several family members that have cancer. You know, the first thing they do is they go on the internet, right? And they become experts on whatever form of cancer it is or whatever, you know, strange disease they might have. And it's amazing. People are self-experts now on their own, and they shop around and they can find out, you know, this is what they're doing out in Arizona. This is what they're doing at this hospital and that hospital. That's what I envision for the future of our healthcare, where people, it's just totally patient-driven, and people can go out there and find what they want. And then, by the way, what I would do is provide a you know, more catastrophic coverage for those serious illnesses, God forbid that any of us has a real traumatic experience, and that's how I would deal with it. Now, for the poor people, what I would do is just, instead of creating this crazy Obamacare structure where you're going to have the government regulate prices and so on, what I would do is just put the money, in other words, just give them a health care voucher and say, okay, here's the money, whatever, we could decide how much it would be, $5,000, $8,000, $10,000. Just tell that poor family, you go out and buy health insurance in the open market. And I just think that kind of model would work a lot better. One other quick thing about this, because it is important. One of the reasons these countries like Germany and France and Italy and Spain and China have lower health care costs than we do. And they do. They do have, they stay, you know, even adjusting for quality, their cost of care is lower than ours is because they are free riders. They are free riding on American technological. All of the major breakthroughs in medicine are happening here in the United States. And the problem is we can't free ride on anybody else, right? If we don't do the innovation in healthcare and cancer treatments and all of these other, you know, dealing with all these other diseases, nobody else is going to do it. And so that's why I think it's a little unfair. That's why, you know, a lot of these, we invest these incredible drugs to deal with hypertension and heart disease and stroke and so on. They're amazing innovations, and then it's almost like the other countries are stealing the technologies for us, and they're you know, not being charged the capital costs of developing this. And that's why I do think it's a little bit of a distortion to say, well, our health care is more expensive than theirs is because we're paying for all the new technologies. Does that answer your question at all? Or? Okay, thank you, sir. Yeah, any? Yeah, ma'am. Don't be bashful.
Thank you for coming. I appreciate sure. your perspective. I was just wondering, you spoke about the current monetary policies that have been happening over the last 5 years.
The what policies?
Monetary
policies. Yep.
And you spoke about, you really emphasized the problem of inflation and yep. the expansionary policies. What do you say to people that are more concerned about deflation in a time of recession?
Yeah, great question about deflation. First of all, I don't see it. Where's the deflation? Now, it is true. There are some industries where there are deflation. When I talked about the fact that, you know, when I showed you that chart with the, you know, consumer items, I'll show you that again. This, you know, what this is showing you, those blue pillars, that's deflation, right? You know, in those industries, computer, software, apparel, vehicles, we have deflation in those industries. That the prices are falling, and the reason the prices are falling is because of productivity improvements. You know, computers are developing so much, you know, more rapidly. They're becoming cheaper all the time. That's good deflation. That's what you want to see. But overall, if you look at the overall economy, we're not seeing deflation because of higher commodity prices, the higher costs of things like education, medical care, and food. And look, right now, I just don't see deflation. If you look at what's happening, look, when you have nearly $5 a gallon gasoline, you don't have deflation. You've got inflation. Because it's interesting, what are the two things that the average American families buy the most of? Food and energy, right? Those are the two things we buy the most of. What are the two things that are rising the most rapidly in price right now? Food and energy. And so I don't buy the idea there's deflation. I think we have too expansionary a policy. And I want to show you one other thing. I think I have this chart. You know, the gold, the price of gold. One piece of investment advice, because I know a lot of you may go into the investment business, one of the things that I track every day is the price of gold. Because I think the real measure of the value of the dollar is its price is how it's priced in gold, right? So look at this picture. You can see what happened in the Carter years. Remember when the big inflation that I showed you? Look what happened to the price of gold. The gold price went from $35 an ounce to I think it went up to as high as $600, $800. And then Reagan comes in and he makes the dollar as good as gold again. Inflation comes down. You could say over the next 20 years under Reagan, Bush, and Clinton, the price of gold did nothing, right? That means we had a very stable currency. One of the reasons George W. Bush will go down in history as a failed economic president, look at what happened to the price of gold under Reagan. What that means is the price of gold tripled. He came into office, the price of gold was $300 an ounce. He left office, the price of gold was closer to $800 an ounce. Now what's happened this is a little out of date, but under Obama, the price of gold has gone in just 3 years from $800 an ounce to $1,600 an ounce. That is inflation. That is inflation, right? The rising price of gold. Why do people buy gold? Why do people buy gold? As a hedge against inflation. When you see a rising price of gold, that means people are very worried about what's going to happen to the price of everything else in the society, and so they invest in gold. By the way, I think gold is a very good buy right now. I mean, Ben Bernanke basically said that we're going to have two more years of zero interest rate policies and flooding the economy with cheap dollars. The way to combat that and to protect yourself against that is by real commodities like gold. So I do think, look, I'm not saying there's runaway inflation. It's not the 1970s where we had, you know, I'll never forget this. Just quick story. In 1980, when Carter was president, and thankfully in his last year in office, it was 14% inflation, 14%. So I was working as a grocery store clerk. Never forget this. So when I came home from school, senior year in high school, I ride my bike to the corner grocery store. I go in, and my job was to take, this is before most of you were born. All you guys know is those barcodes that are on the thing. But back then, we had these sticker machines where you take the stickers and you put the price, you know, you put the price on everything, the boxes of Wheaties and the cans of vegetables. And every other, about two times a week, I'd come in and my boss would give me the sticker machine and say, time to put higher prices on everything, because prices were rising so rapidly. And I used to walk down the shelves with that little machine and people would be taking everything off the shelf as fast as they could at the lower price before I could put the higher price on. I'd get in the tug of war with these ladies. You know, I'd be trying to make the, you know, put the higher price on the Wheaties. And back then, the joke back then in 1980 was if you found a dollar bill lying on the ground, you'd pick it up to see if there was anything of value underneath it, because, you know, the dollar had just plummeted in value. No country, one of the things, if Ben Bernanke were here right now, I'd say, sir, with all due respect, there is no example in history when a country got rich by deflating its currency and devaluing its currency, and that's what's happening in the United States. Now, I was on TV this morning with who's this economist who's written this book about financial crises? I'm blanking out his name, but he's got a big best-selling list about best-selling book. It's a very good book about, you know, the 500 years of financial crises. And what he Ken Rogoff is his name. And what he said on CNN this morning is he said what we really need to do right now is reflate the economy. We need more money creation. And I said, Ken, are you kidding me? How high do you want the price of gasoline to go? Right? Do you want $10 a gallon gasoline? I mean, if we keep inflating, you're going to see the price of all these things rise. Now he thinks, well, that's going to cause housing prices to rise, it's going to cause a rebound. And I'm saying, look, what we did in the 80s to turn around the failed economy of the 70s was just the opposite of what we're doing today. We cut the tax rates and slammed the brakes on the money supply. What Obama and Bernanke are doing is just the opposite. They want to raise the tax rates and you know, put the pedal to the metal on the money supply. And I just think that's a witch's brew of bad policy. Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else before we? Don't be bashful.
Thank you for speaking tonight. So one comment I had was, I figure the LASIK eye surgery issue stems mostly from asymmetric information, and in that you can probably know when you need LASIK eye surgery, but that more serious medical condition.
Wait, no, I actually want to understand this. So,
I'm asking.
I don't understand what you mean by asymmetrical.
Well, I think if you're looking for LASIK eye surgery, it's a fairly common thing in that you have terrible vision and you see this LASIK eye surgery or placement for glasses. But that if you go in with chest pains, you have to get a whole slew of medical tests, which is the difference.
Oh, that's a fair point. Oh, okay.
Thank you. And then throwing it out there.
I think it's a fair point, but I do think because of the new internet age, that's the point I was making about people are becoming experts. You know, look, if you have cancer,
God forbid, you're going to find out everything you can about it, right? You're going to find out who's the best doctor in the country, what's the best treatment, what are the new new age technology, because that's the thing, these things are changing all the time. So I'm really impressed with the people, the way Americans are becoming experts, and that asymmetrical information, point that you're making might not be as valid today as it might have been 20 years ago. But it's a fair point.
And then I guess my question would be, what are your views on shock therapy or economic shock therapy? And just that it sounded like when you talk about cutting back on all the monetary policies, cutting back on taxes, and letting the banks fail, it sounded like a complete drastic reduction of government activity in the economy in order to boost it.
That's a great question. So let me just say this, that on letting the banks fail, and that might have been the most controversial thing I said tonight, because I think the vast majority of economists would disagree with me on that. And look, I talked to President Bush about this the other day when I saw him at this conference in New York, and I said, I think that was a mistake that you bailed out the banks, and he said we had to do it, and blah, blah, blah. It's always hard to figure out what the counterfactual is. In other words, like Obama said, if Obama's economists were here right now, they'd say, how in the world can you say, that the stimulus was a mistake? I mean, we saved the world from a Great Depression and so on. Well, nobody knows what the counterfactual. No one knows for sure what would have happened if we hadn't done this. We don't know what would have happened if we hadn't done the stimulus. I think the economy would have grown a hell of a lot faster, and I don't think we'd have $5 trillion of debt today. But they may be right. We might have had a Great Depression if we hadn't done it. And I make the same point about the bank bailout. If we hadn't done this bank bailout, I think what you would have seen is the healthy banks that were still standing would have bought up the assets of the unhealthy banks that were failing, right? I mean, this is what happens during the process of bankruptcy. And so, this is the kind of Darwinian nature of our capitalist system. The strong survive and the weak die out. And the reason why I think that's a better system than having everybody bail out failed banks is because when you do that, you have two negative effects. One negative effect is that you're taking money from me that I don't want taken from me to give it to people who made bad decisions. We're doing this in the housing market, by the way. This is a little bit of a sidetrack, but one of the stupidest thing we keep doing on housing policy, we keep paying people to pay, to pay their mortgages, right? People took out took these big risks on their mortgages, signed these mortgages that they couldn't afford. We called them victims, but I don't think most of the people who signed these big mortgages were victims. I think they were just greedy. They thought they could catch the upside of the housing market. Now the people who acted responsibly have to pay for that. My wife has a bumper sticker in her car that says, honk if I paid your mortgage, and everywhere she goes, people are honking at her, because that's what we've done. We've created the system where everybody's paying for everybody else's mortgage. No, I don't think the government should bail out people who make bad decisions. Period. If you sign a legal document that you're going to pay this mortgage and you can't pay it, then you go through the bankruptcy process. You don't come to me for money. And what we've done, I think, there's a moral hazard problem to all of these bailouts. And you see this in the banking industry now. We have created, for better or worse, we had this whole debate about what's called too big to fail, whether banks are too big to fail now. You know what? Banks, because of what we did in 2008, whether we like it or not, banks in America today are too big to fail. They are. Everyone knows that if Citibank has another financial crisis, we're going to run in and bail them out again, right? So what effect do you think that has? What it does is it leads to more risky decisions, right? And that's what a moral hazard is. You're protecting people from making really, really bad decisions. So I think we would have been much better off letting the strong survive, the weak die off. That would have been shock. That's a good way to describe it, shock therapy, because it would have been tough love. It would have been a very tough adjustment period, but I think we would have come out of it much better than we have today. So,
thank you.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else before we close up? Anybody want to ask one last question? Okay. You got the last one, sir.
Okay. So you've talked a lot about how this inflation you're seeing, you're talking a lot about seeing in natural gas and oil.
Yeah.
And my question is, Private trading in natural gas and oil is something that has only existed in the last decade and a half. It was illegal. Private speculation in gas and oil. And so where you see inflation, some other people just see natural volatility that becomes introduced when you open a market up to speculation. It's the same thing that happened in the Forex market after the end of Bretton Woods. So my question is, how much do you think this change in price is actually due to inflation, and how much do you think it's just a market naturally being volatile and rising as situations such as what's happening in the Middle East lead you to speculation and, you know, hedging against the risk of reductions in supply in oil, especially as Iran continuously threatens to shut down oil?
Well, first of all, I mean, that's a great question. First of all, on speculation, I'm sorry, I just don't buy in the conspiracy theory that speculators are the one driving up the price, because, look, you can speculate on either end of the market. If you think that they're artificially driving up the price, you can short the market, right? And you can make, so for everybody who's bidding up the price, somebody can come in and short the market if they're so smart, and they'll make a killing if they're right that the price is artificially being driven up. Do you understand the point I'm making?
My question isn't that it's artificially being driven up. It says just being more volatile. I remember...
it is. I mean, although actually the fact that we have speculators in the market, and that the fact that we have what are called, futures markets in energy, actually what futures markets do is they equilibrate the price today with the price 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. So futures markets make the market much more efficient in the trading of things like corn and copper and oil and natural gas. But your other point is a good one. I mean, there's no question that the reason one of the reasons we're seeing this spike up in gasoline prices clearly because of what's happening in the Middle East. I mean, I apologize for not mentioning that, because you're exactly right. And we see this every time we see a flare-up in the Middle East. We see these big shocks in the price of oil and gas. And by the way, this is why it's so exciting, though, that we actually have the capacity to be self-sufficient in oil and gas. If we go, full throttle on drilling, Outer Continental Shelf, in Colorado, in Montana, in all of these places, if we do that, then all of a sudden we're not nearly as susceptible to the price shocks when the next time, there's some, Arab-Israeli war or something like that. So I just think I think it's both in our national security interest and our interest in terms of our economy that we're actually creating this stuff ourselves rather than having to import it from countries that hate us, like Saudi Arabia and Iran and Venezuela and so on. I mean, that's the other kind of freak of geology, that so much of the oil over the last 50 years has been in these hostile countries that don't think very much of the United States. So, all right. Well, thank you all very much for being here, and we can talk a little bit more during the Q&A. Thanks.